I'd like to welcome everybody to the Lunch and Learn on Parshas Bamidbar. It's exciting whenever we start a new book. It's only 5 books in the Torah, and this is number 4. And you start off with a fresh perspective and with a certain an expectation that the Parsha, the book, is going to reveal a certain aspect of Torah that we haven't had until now. And it's a little bit of a challenge when we start by Midbar, particularly with the first Parsha of Bamidbar, the Parsha called Bamidbar. When we read it, we notice the various subjects that are discussed, such as the census that the Moshe took of the Jewish people in the desert, counting every male of a certain age, 20 and up, enumerating the different tribal leaders, their names, and then the results of the census, the numbers of people of each tribe, and then the counting of the Levites, and then a very detailed description of the format, the formation of the Jewish camp, where the tribes situated themselves around the tabernacle. The tabernacle in the middle, tribes on all 4 sides, where exactly each tribe camped, who were his neighbors, who was on the west, who was on the east, and the north, and the south, and then where the Levites were situated. You're kind of like waiting for, okay, that's the introduction, let's get to the meat. And before you know it, the Parsha is over. That was the meat. And the question is, I mean, number one, what do we learn from this? It seems to be important instructions for people living at that time. If you lived in the desert, and this was the first time they were actually setting up a camp, then you would have to know where to go. But, okay, that's for them. But what does it have to do with the Torah, which is timeless, which is instructions for living in every generation, for every place, and every time? When we study about the sacrifices, we say, well, there will be sacrifices in the future. God willing, the Mashiach will come and we'll rebuild the temple and we will reinstate the sacrifices, like we say in our prayers. But we're never going to live in the desert again. We're not going to have a portable Mishkan which moves. So what's the timeless relevance of these instructions? Many of the stories in the Torah teach us how people acted, how they related to one another, how they dealt with conflict. You know, in Bereishis we have many stories like that. This seems to be very technical and not about people or relationships. So really, one is a little bit lost on the message of Bamidbar when one first opens it. And actually, I think that one could notice that in the entire book of Bamidbar, there's very little in the area of mitzvos. Now, if somebody asked you, what's the Torah? What would you say? Let's say somebody stopped you on the street and said, what is that Torah that I always hear the Jews talking about? What would you, on a one-line answer, how would you explain what the Torah
Laws
is?
Of living.
Laws of living. Very good. Would everyone else say something similar? The laws of how the Jewish people are supposed to live, it's the instructions for God, it's the 613 commandments. Very few.
The story of the Jewish people.
The story of the Jewish people. That's an interesting answer. Is the Torah about history? Is the Torah written to be historical?
Not only.
At all? Is the Torah there for history?
If so, it's a very cool history.
Rashi, I think Rashi doesn't believe so. Because Rashi, on the very first verse in the Torah, in Bereishis, asks a question. It's not his own question. He's quoting Rabbi Yitzchak from the Midrash. It says, why didn't the Torah start with Exodus chapter 12? Because Exodus chapter 12 is the first time there's a mitzvah. It's a commandment from God to the Jewish people. The fact that up until then we have the history of the creation and the story of the patriarchs and of the 12 sons and of the sojourn in Egypt and the Exodus, that didn't seem to justify its appearance in the Torah, it seems, from the question. Well, the answer is that it does, but...
It's all a building block.
Okay.
Is there been direction we would attack Pesach
team until you have enough players to...
Okay, the answer is that it is relevant, but if the Torah was intended to be a history, I don't think the question would have even begun. What kind of question is that? Why does it have the history of the first 2,448 years? Of course it should.
Where would we be without them?
Well, we'd still be here, but we didn't have to have it in the Torah.
Not without that. Without those first years?
So no. The question is not why did those events happen. The question is why is it recorded in the five books of Moshe? It doesn't record everything. So the question is, why is it recorded? So there seems to be a basic premise that the Torah is written, as Linda said, because it's instructions for living. And if that's the premise, and that everything that's in the Torah has to be justified by the relevance that it has to teaching a Jew how to conduct his or her life, and to relate to God and to relate to each other, then it begs the question in Parshas Bamidbar. Parshas Bamidbar, not only is it historical, but even in history it doesn't even seem so significant. It doesn't seem to have any... How they camped, how many people were in each tribe, that's a fact of the past, you know. So that's a question, I think, that is always my first question when I open up the Parsha of Bamidbar. That's usually because I forget what I learned the year before. But my first and foremost question that always enters my mind is, what's the point of knowing all of these technical details that don't seem to have lasting relevance?
Maybe one significant idea is that it shows some sort of a hierarchy of the tribes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the situation for the Levites and the situation for Judah.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, those things aren't relevant even.
Well, they are. No, they are. We still have we don't know our tribe so much, but we still have the differentiation between the priests and the Levites and the Israelites. There are still honors that are given to the priests first. They get the first aliyah. However, those things are really stated in other portions of the Torah. That's not the primary purpose here. The primary purpose here is to outline, as we said, the formation of a camp. We know from many other commandments that the Kohanim are given certain honors and the Levites certain honors and the Israelites. That doesn't seem to be the primary focus of Bamidbar. So it still remains somewhat of a question. All right, now I have a lead on this question. We should know this from our theme this year. We're studying the Torah with the insights of Rav Dessler. So a lead to this would be, what does Rav Dessler say? Let's find out what he says. And in fact, he has a very short essay on, entitled Duglei Midbar, The Banners of the Desert. And in reference to the Parsha here today, how each side of the camp had a degel, a banner. Actually, each tribe had a banner. If you
a flag with
a certain emblem on it. Some of that is in the Midrash and the oral tradition, but article uses the term banner. So there's a banner of Reuven, a banner of Ephraim, a banner of Dan, and so on and so forth. So he has an essay entitled The Banners of the Desert. And his purpose is to explain what is so significant about these banners. So, Diglei Midbar, the banners of the Midbar, to Rav Dessler, is teaching us the importance of the concept of Seder. Seder, order. Right? We have a Seder on Pesach. Now you can... The Seder on Pesach, we order more in terms of procedure. But there's also Seder in terms of spatial arrangement. How things are set up, in what order. Thank you. And that seems to be an important theme. So, what's the importance of Seder? So, let's start off with an analogy which he alludes to. I'm gonna just beef it up a little bit. Okay. You go to your office. Okay, every day you go to work in an office. And you hope, you try to keep that office in order. Right? Some people don't mind if it's not in order. Some people thrive on it. Like the guy who was upset when the cleaning person came and says, now I won't be able to find anything because everything's in order. I can only find things when they're messed up. But most people appreciate order. Why do we appreciate order? Tell me your reasons, what you think is why you would appreciate having an orderly office. Okay?
Well, it takes less energy to do things because you don't have to be confused and go here and there. You know where something is.
And it's a time saver.
Time saver. You know where to find things. It's easy, it's more efficient in terms of getting things done. Somebody just told me, I was talking to somebody about this, and they said that they have a business, and they were speaking to a customer, and the customer was on the phone, and the customer was asking some questions about the prices, and he says, well, did you see the fax that I sent you? He said, well, hold on, the fax is in the other room, fax machine. So he had to put down the phone and go to the other room, get the fax, and then come back and discuss it. You know, if he would have had the phone next to the fax, he would be able to work much more efficiently and effectively. How about anything else?
About control.
Okay.
If things are in order.
Okay.
If things are in order, then you can manage them instead of they
managing you. What's the difference between a person who feels in control and in order and a person who feels chaotic? How do they feel inside?
The person in control can be more relaxed because he's got things covered and
knows.
Chaotic.
Exactly. There's peace. There's inner peace that comes with order. Right? So for all these reasons, it's advantageous. We enjoy it. We appreciate it. Having order in our lives because, again, to outline it, it's we know where to find things. We work more efficiently and effectively, and there's a certain inner peace that comes with it. So Rav Dessler says, here in the Torah is telling us it's very important to have order. It's very important to have order, not just in terms of clutter. It's very important to have a deliberate arrangement for the living conditions of the Jewish people. This is the very first time the Jewish people are setting up a community. You know, we got the Torah. We were instructed to build a Mishkan, which would be the tabernacle, which would be in the center. And God is giving us instructions on how to create a community of the Jewish people. All the Jewish people, that's all they are. They all live here around the Mishkan. And he says it's very important to have an order. These tribes live here. These tribes live there. These tribes live here and so on. It's not just a free-for-all. Looking for everyone go out and try to buy a piece of real estate and see where you can live. It's nothing like this. Where should I live? Should I live in that neighborhood? Should I live in this neighborhood? Should I live in the suburbs? Should I live in the city? There's instructions. God is saying part of the Torah is to live in a very, very defined and a predetermined arrangement. So the question is why? Why is that important to God? And again, it doesn't mean that we have to do that because we're not in the desert. We were not given instructions. Certainly in the exile, as Jeffrey referred to, in Israel there were certain tribal portions. But let's even try to figure out why. What's the spiritual advantage to this? So that we can find each other? So I know where my house is? Is it for the reasons we described earlier? Is there more peace? Is there more? Am I more relaxed if all of my tribesmen live in one area?
The same why? Configuration of Jacob's funeral.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The sages tell us that when Jacob was carried, the body of Jacob was carried by his sons from Egypt to the land of Israel for burial, they surrounded his coffin, his aron, in the same arrangement that later on they would take in setting up the camp. Very interesting. So what's the idea here? It's a very, very deep idea, says Rav Dessler. And this is the difference between looking at everything on a surface level and looking at things for their deeper spiritual essence. Seder, the importance of Seder has to do with the way we work effectively. There's different tribes. The tribes come from different sons. Each of Yaakov's different sons was unique. Each one had a different personality. Each one had a different strength. As we read through the stories of Bereshis and about the different tribes, how they interacted, Joseph, Judah, how Judah took a leadership role, taking responsibility. Joseph was a leader in his own right, but Judah stuck out his neck in order to save his brother Binyamin. We don't, know too much about each of the tribes as we learn through the Chumash, but we get glimpses here and there, and throughout the Tanakh, we see that different tribes play different roles. When you have a group of people, it's very important to recognize and identify the uniqueness of each person. And the way that we recognize the uniqueness and we treasure the uniqueness of each person is to keep them separate and to declare this person is unique for this reason. And the problem of making a society where everybody is the same, everyone's a name or just a number, and they're stripped of their individuality, is that the people really can't perform based on the gifts that they were given, the spiritual gifts and the spiritual mission that everyone has. So there's an importance of delineation. And this is what God meant when he said that every tribe has its banner and every tribe has its location. Reuven has to live with Reuven. Shimon has to live with Shimon. And they cannot just live wherever they want. If anybody could live wherever they want, then pretty soon a member of the Reuven tribe has lost his uniqueness, his identity as a bearer of the banner of Reuven, so to speak. Well, for that matter then, God could have said, let every tribe live in its own camp, and let there be a distance, a large distance between one camp and the other. Let Reuven be off in that country, Shimon in that country, Levi in that country, and this way they will preserve their identity. But God didn't choose that. God said there will be groups of camps, groups of tribes. Yehuda will camp with Yisachar and Zebulun. Ephraim will camp with Manasseh and Benjamin. Okay? And Reuven will camp with Shimon and Gad. Why did God arrange them that way? Why did he choose? Why did he have set seating rather than open seating? He could have just said, here's a slot for a tribe. Anyone go fill it. All right. He didn't want them to fight. He didn't want them to rush for the same seat. But there's something more here. God is saying that the quality that Yehuda has works well with the quality that Yisachar has and the quality that Zebulun has. The idea of a community, the idea of a nation, is A, identify the uniqueness of the qualities of each member, and B, have them work together and interact with each other to create a greater whole. Yes, each person is unique, but it can only contribute, it can only lead to good things if we work together in tandem. You providing your unique qualities together with your unique qualities and together with your unique qualities. And God knows the makeup of each person, which works together with which. There's indeed a midrash that Rav Dessler cites, I think which was originally quoted by Nachmanides, as to what the quality of each tribe was and why they worked well together in these particular combinations. Yehuda was the tribe of leadership, producing the kings, and that went together with Yisachar, who had excellent Torah scholars. And Torah scholars and Zebulun had successful merchants. So think of this combination, right? Without merchants, without business people, the scholars have no support. Without scholarship, without Torah leadership, the leaders, the kings, don't have the direction. And so God is creating a strong formation by combining the uniqueness of Yehuda with the uniqueness of Yisachar, with the uniqueness of Zebulun. The idea is separate but together. Separate but together. Delineated one from the other, not blurring, but taking those separate parts and joining them together to make them work together as a whole. This is the Torah's formula for Jewish community. The formula for Jewish community, and that's why it's a timeless message. The definition of Jewish unity, the Jewish community, is everyone is encouraged to bring their unique qualities to the fore. We do not blur that by denying and failing to recognize those qualities. Number two, we realize that we can only produce and create the kind of community that we are supposed to in honor of God when we work together, and we have to find out how we can play on each other's strengths. And number three, of course, the idea that in the center of the camp is the Mishkan, is the tabernacle of God. This is a powerful message. It's a timeless message. Individuality, combining our efforts, and putting God in the center, working together for the glory of God, for the service of God. And this is the Torah's formula for Jewish community. It doesn't matter. In other words, it doesn't matter if we're living in the desert or if we're living in the land of Israel. These principles are timeless. That we always have to try to incorporate this, even if in less than a formal manner, if it's not explicitly spelled out as clear as this, but still the idea, the principles are the same for all of us. This is the idea of Seder, of formation of the Jewish camp that Rav Dessler sees in here, and it's really something. And maybe this will be kind of an introduction to the book of Bamidbar, that we are going to be learning in this book how people work together with their differences. And sometimes it's done properly. We're going to learn some stories of breakdown between some of the bonds between the different tribes, and learn from that also. We learn from the good and we learn from the bad. But that this may be the outline of the book of Bamidbar. It is how to live together as a Jewish community with the essentials that God has taught us. Yes, Linda.
In the light of the fact that we don't really know what tribes, I mean, is it true that we don't know what tribes?
It's true. It's true.
So when someone says they're when you say you're a Kohen, is that accurate?
To a degree. Unfortunately or fortunately, whatever the case may be, the kinds of honors that are given to the Kohen do not require the absolute verification of their identity. To be called up to the Torah, it's sufficient to say, well, this is what my father told me. If the temple was to be rebuilt, and there are certain areas that only Kohanim can enter, and if, you know, at the penalty of death, we're not just going to be so casual about saying, well, I think I'm a Kohen, you know. But then we're told that Eliyahu, the prophet, is going to come, and he's going to straighten it all out and tell us which tribe we're from. But most of us don't know the tribe.
So in the light of that, how do we really manifest our unique?
That's a valid question, and that's why I say that we have to take the essentials out of this rather than the specific application. Each one of us has unique qualities. We all have to recognize that and celebrate that.
It's interesting.
But at the same time, we also have to learn from the essential of working together. And we don't relate to God just as individuals. The concept of I have my God, and I'm gonna go and, you know, seclude myself. We don't. That's not a Jewish value. Al tifrosh min hatzibor, the sages say in Pirkei Avos, don't separate yourself from the tzibor, from the community. Realize that all your unique qualities are valuable in the way that they can contribute to the common. To the common service of God. And that's something that we can apply today. Yes?
To me, what strikes me as being very interesting is the fact of the conception of the 360-degree circle.
Ah.
And,
I don't want to spoil your image there, but I don't know if it was a circle or a square. Would that make a big difference?
Well, symbolically, probably.
But it's the idea of being around the tabernacle.
So, back then when the tribes were living separately but close, did they marry within their tribe, or if they married without their tribe, would the woman then come and live with the tribe?
It's a good question. Except for one particular exception, one generation where they made some type of a decree. Tribes could intermarry. Yeah, and then the wife would become the member. Her and her children would become the members of the husband's tribe. The exception came about when. It's actually in the end of the book of Bamidbar. Somebody comes to Moshe and says, "We have a problem here. There's a particular individual who has only daughters, and they're all going to get married. They're going to inherit from their father, because as long as there is a son, the son gets the inheritance. If there are only daughters, the daughters get the inheritance." And so the problem was that these daughters were going to inherit their father's portion in the land of Israel, and then they were going to marry men from other tribes. And then that land would be diminished from the tribe of their father and go onto another tribe, which would be less land. Also, it would be a mixing of the So Moshe said that, I think it was a temporary thing, right? That if a daughter is of a family of only daughters, she should marry men from her tribe. But otherwise, there could be mobility that way. But the lineage went through the father. Yeah, it's interesting. Rosenbaum always points this out. You're a Kohen because of your father, but you're a Jew because of your mother. That goes through the mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Father is Egyptian, and he comes out and
desecrates
the holy name of God. I don't remember what happened to him. I think he's stoned.
He's stoned, right?
Yeah. But the issue wasn't the issue of him where he couldn't live with the tribe of his mother,
right?
Or
right, because since he did not have a Jewish father, therefore he didn't really belong to a tribe.
Right, and so how should he have been dealt with?
How should he? What was the right thing? Right, that's a good question. It's at the end of Amor, I think. The blasphemer. So what should he do? You know, that's another question. What do the converts do also? Where do they live? Do you know where the Gerim live? Yeah, sure. They were Gerim as soon as there was the Torah. They may have been just given land among the other tribes. Oh, here we go. Another version of the strife, this is in Emor, we had it a few weeks ago, indicated by the information we are given regarding the ancestry of the two combatants, and the term Bamachane, in the camp, which implies that the dispute revolved around matters of the camp. See, the Torah says that there was a, it says, the son of an Israelite woman went out. He was the son of an Egyptian man among the children of Israel. They fought in the camp, the son of the Israelite woman and an Israelite man.
Egyptian.
Yeah. Well, the son of the Israelite woman was fighting with the Israelite man.
Right.
So what were they, and the son of the Israelite woman pronounced the name and blasphemed. So they brought him to Moshe. So what were they arguing about? So the footnote here says that the blasphemer was the son of a Jewish mother from the tribe of Dan and an Egyptian father. Throughout the years of enslavement, this was the only such case. Remarkable testimony to the Jewish family purity and morality. He wished to dwell among the people of Dan, his mother's tribe, but they refused him on the grounds that his father was not a Danite. He wasn't Danish. Although he was a Jew, since his mother was Jewish, membership in the tribe follows the father's family. The court of Moses ruled in favor of Dan, which is that they did not have to welcome him in. Whereupon the man uttered his curse. It doesn't say what should be. What is the law?
It was tribal.
My guess, I don't know. I don't know the real answer. My guess is that they are treated as they are to be invited. It would be like a case of, you know, I don't want to say charity, but he's invited by whoever will invite him to come live with them, and he's got to accept it. In other words, he doesn't have the prerogative to say, well, I must be in this tribe or in that tribe. That's my guess is what the law would be for a convert or for a situation of a Jewish mother, not a Jewish father. Well, now, let's say this man marries and has a son. So the son still doesn't belong to a tribe. But if he has a daughter, the daughter marries another man and becomes part of that tribe. And so, I don't know, you got to get linked.
Never talks about presents to the poor. It says, unease of like gear. He should give the presents to the poor people and to
the convert, because the convert doesn't have land. I mean, he may not get any land. He may be supported by charity.
But he wouldn't be a convert.
Whenever it says about giving charity, it always mentions the convert. Because the convert doesn't necessarily have land.
He wouldn't be a convert because his mother was Jewish.
No, not this person, right. But in general, converts didn't have land either. Ruth, the story of Ruth. That she... Now, her mother really was from her husband was from the tribe of Yehuda, but Ruth went and gleaned droppings from the people in the harvesters. That's how they got their food.
So she was, but she had a Jewish parent. I missed this.
No, she didn't have a Jewish parent. Her mother-in-law, I'm sorry. Her mother-in-law was Naomi, and Naomi was the wife of a Judite. It says in the Torah...
Become part of that tribe from your mother-in-law.
Well, she married Boaz.
Right.
And Boaz also was from Judah.
Oh, awesome.
And so her children were for Judites as well. It says in the Torah, I don't know, 36 times, don't forget about the convert. Because we have to remember that they don't have.
Who's counting?
Maybe 45 times. Okay, that's it. It's not so long, but it's very important to have Seder. Shkoach to you all. Have a good Shabbos.